Good morning. I'd like to call the committee to order. We are still just one member short of quorum, but I'd like to get started because we do have a full agenda this morning, and I know that members are anxious to get a start on their well-deserved rest for the week because we've been all, I think, burning the midnight oil a lot around here, and we do have a lot to cover this morning. So we're going to start this morning with House File 1395, Representative Dean. And Representative Dean, since we don't have a quorum yet, we'll just we won't move your bill, but maybe we can get started on the presentation of the bill and the maybe even the discussion. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Since it hasn't been moved, I'll just mention that right now you have in front of you House File 1395. It's asking for the removing the limitations on HCBS waivers in a building. And I'm going to make a few comments, and then I'll have a few other folks testify as well. Part of this comes from Clare Housing. Clare Housing has been a leader in transforming and innovation of supportive housing for people living with HIV/AIDS. Clare Housing is the largest provider for people living with HIV and AIDS in Minnesota, annually serving 150 individuals of the roughly 7,000 people statewide who are low income and have experienced homelessness, long-term homelessness, or at risk of becoming homelessness. Clare Housing helps people in settings they are choosing that suits their needs. We should not be limiting access to safe housing for these people in need. In 2012, the Minnesota State Legislature enacted legislation that limited the ability of people living in a single building to receive home and community-based services waiver benefits. This legislation states that no more than 25% of people living in any one building can receive HCBS waivers. Last year, the legislature believed that CMS was going to employ a similar cap on these regulations. However, CMS has not issued a final ruling on that matter, and subsequent proposed rulings have not included caps, as CMS does not restrict HCBS waivers in buildings. The state of Minnesota should not either. So today, I mean, I have heard some concerns of members about lifting this cap for fear of allowing warehousing-style housing. The fact is that we as a state should not limit successful facilities like Clare from helping those in needs, and we know that there's need out there, as currently Clare has more than 200 people on a waiting list looking for supportive housing. So to ensure that maximum choice for all these individuals with disabilities, the cap should be removed, and law that receiving HCBS benefits to determine what they, where they want to live on their own. House File 1395 is also supported by care providers, AARM, Minnesota AIDS Project, and other organizations here today. We have other organizations here today to speak to this change.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dean. We now have a quorum. So I'll move Representative Dean's bill. So I move that House File 1395 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we do have an amendment in the packet, and I don't know if perhaps what we ought to do before we get to that amendment is hear from the rest of the testifiers. Is that, Representative Loeffler, was that your amendment? Or
No, Chair,
okay.
We're still waiting for that.
All right. Okay, so we'll just continue hearing from the testifiers, Representative Dean.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. And at this time, I do not want to offer the author's amendment to this.
Okay. Oh, that came from you, the A2?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So the A2 will not be offered. So we have some other testifiers then, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you, and committee members. My name is Lee Lewis. I'm the Executive Director of Clare Housing. Representative Dean has described what we do. I will tell you a little bit more detail. We started in 1984. We started with hospice care, licensed as adult foster care. As you all know, the epidemic has changed significantly over the last couple of decades, and we have changed our services as well. So we still have we have three different programs. We have the adult foster homes. The folks who live in those homes are significantly disabled, would otherwise be in nursing homes, and some of them are at the end of their lives. We have four of those homes. We also have two permanent supportive housing sites. One is 32 units, one is 45 units. Affordable housing, permanent supportive housing. In those buildings, we also have assisted living available, and that's where the home and community-based waivers are used. We also have 20, soon to be 25, scattered site units where we provide rental assistance in the community. And we've applied for rental assistance to do scattered site housing in southeast Minnesota in cooperation with Rural AIDS Action Network and the Mayo Clinic. The 25% limit on home and community-based waivered services in one setting, in essence, knocks out a major option that people have. We will not be able to replicate our single-site permanent supportive housing with assisted living. We won't be able to do it. And the reason for that is because, just to make the numbers work, we have to have 14 or 15 people receiving the waivers to provide the care. That means we'd have to have a 60-unit building, and we aren't going to build 60-unit buildings. Let me tell you a little, just briefly, what the waiver does. It provides the assisted living program for folks who have HIV, disabled, would otherwise be in nursing homes. They get a nursing assessment, nursing care, 24/7 response, and assistance with personal cares if they need it. They own their own apartment, they have their own kitchen, but they do need a certain level of support that we're able to provide in the assisted living program. So if the 25%, those two programs are grandparented in, but we do want to do more scattered site housing and more single site housing, and we're only going to be able to do the scattered site housing. We will not be able to do the assisted living under this legislation. I want to say a couple of things. Number one, costs will not go up. Caddy costs will not go up. They're capped. What will happen is probably more people will be able to be served. An example, when we opened Clare Midtown in 2011, five individuals moved from our adult foster home into Clare Midtown, affordable rent, with the assisted living program at $100 less per day per person. It's much less expensive to provide those services in that setting than it is in the adult foster home setting. So, and costs won't go up because caddy is capped. We'll probably be able to serve more people because for some folks the costs will go down. So, in sum, I believe that the cap will remove choice for consumers. It's one less option available for folks who need a service-rich living environment. We will simply not be able to replicate a very successful program. So I'm going to hand it over to Matt Corrin.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lewis, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Toburin, the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota AIDS Project. And our mission is to stop the spread of HIV in Minnesota and to support and serve those who are currently living with the disease. We feel it's important to come and speak in support of House File 1395 today. We do not own or run any supportive housing units and would not benefit one way or the other from this legislation, but the people who would benefit are our clients, who desperately need affordable housing and many of whom would love to live at Clare if given the opportunity. Many of our clients struggle with homelessness and get on wait lists for years for the opportunity to live in a safe and supportive environment, and for whom getting accepted into Clare is like winning the lottery. HIV is a disease that carries with it a huge amount of stigma and shame and can be very isolating. Because of that stigma, many crave to live in a trusted, safe community with other HIV-positive individuals for support and camaraderie. Current statute was written with the greatest intentions but has created unintended consequences. It's become a barrier that ensures no new Clare housing units will be available in the future. We applaud your past efforts to protect the sickest and most vulnerable in our society from being institutionalized, isolated, and warehoused, but that is not Clare. Please fix this law so that our clients will not be told they cannot live where they choose because the law will not allow them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Other testifiers?
No, I believe that's all we have.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'm yours. Okay, other people who want to testify maybe in opposition or with other perspectives on the bill?
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, I am, and members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson from ARM. We're an association of providers who support people with disabilities across the state of Minnesota. I thought I'd give a little, just a minute's worth of background on how this came to be and where we think it should go. The measure of 25% became part of ARM's reforms that we brought to the legislature last year and Representative Schumacher carried. And we did it to save money in the system, assuming that people would be moving out of corporate foster care into more into less expensive settings and provide more independence. The policy at that time was four persons in a building. So you could have a building of 100, you could have no more than four. Although, as Mr. Lewis is pointing out, some providers had been given the green light to exceed that. Now, ARM's original proposal when we came to the legislature last year and we were working with the department was to be no more restrictive than federal law or rule. We assume people would not only be coming out of corporate foster care, but also their own homes. And because you'd be coming out of their own homes, the department put a fiscal note on it. We think there should be a savings of this. We think, I know there's a fiscal note attached, or there will be, but there should be a savings to this because people will be moving out of corporate foster care, more expensive. We at ARM fully support what this bill is trying to do. We do have reservations, and I know there's conversations going on. If this becomes law and we go back to four persons, that's a concern of ours. If this, in fact, opens up the policy of the state of Minnesota to be no more restrictive than federal law or rule, we would be delighted. And I think people with disabilities across the state of Minnesota could really benefit in having more flexibility in living independent lives and moving into the community as they choose. So that said, we hope we can move forward and open up the system beyond 25%.
All right, thank you. Question, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So I just need some clarity. So did I hear you say that you brought the bill and Representative Schumacher carried a bill to limit it to only four?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the policy at the time that we were working on legislation last year, the policy at the time was four persons. What we wanted to do was open it up to be able to do things like Mr. Lewis and Claire Housing are doing. We thought that was very confining for people who now live in corporate foster care, who may want to move on, and you bump up against that four-person limit. Last year, Representative Abler came in with a proposal of 20%. We tried to start at what this bill is trying to do. Then we proposed 50%, and we reached 25% because that was the point at which the department determined it would be budget neutral. I know the department is reworking the fiscal note. Our assumptions were different in that we believe that there would be far more people coming out of corporate foster care, a more expensive setting, and going into like apartment buildings as an example, than people coming out of their own homes where they have cheaper services. I think now we're seeing some trends, and that fiscal note may be changed.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not exactly sure, maybe it's Representative Den, but last year I had a bill about severely autistic campus housing, and I'm just wondering how this bill would affect that, because right now, the way I understand it, we aren't able to do this campus-type setting because of the four people in a facility cap. So would this kind of open it up to be able to do that?
Representative Dean?
Madam Chair and Representative Lohmer, I don't know, to be honest with you. I think it's possible it might allow that campus to be developed.
Mr. Nelson, do you want to take a stab at that?
Madam Chair, I would have to refer to the department on that one.
Okay.
Is there anybody from the department here, Madam Chair?
Is there anybody from DHS
could maybe
here?
Help us?
Oh, here we go. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, Representative Lohmer. I have not looked at the language considering the campus setting. I'm just speaking off the cuff right now, but based on the study that we did with the Institute on Community Integration at the University of Minnesota, I believe there are other barriers to allowing medical assistance to pay for a campus setting. This is specific to the home and community-based waivers for people with disabilities. And it's our understanding from CMS that we can't pay for large buildings that are controlled by a provider, but I'd have to do more research to figure out if this particular language would allow us to do that campus setting.
All right, thank you. Representative Lohmer, maybe you just want to make note of this particular statutory restriction so that if you do a bill to try to do those services that you're concerned about, you'll know that this might possibly be in your way. Yeah. Okay. And question from Representative Loeffler.
I'll wait till the next testimony.
Okay. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Holste. I represent Care Providers of Minnesota, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. We also support this legislation. Clear Housing is a member of Care Providers of Minnesota. And the reason we support this legislation is because consumer choice, in our minds, should be first and foremost. We have provided technical assistance to a number of our members, and it depends on where you live and how the policy is implemented. We have settings in rural Minnesota where the no more than four is strictly abided by. We have settings in the metro area, for example, where it's 100% caddy, and we support that 100% caddy. And we did work on this legislation to put the no more than 25% last year as well. But there's a bill in this year to remove that cap, and we support that as well. So we have, as I said, provided technical assistance where a person is seeking housing in a rural setting, and they are limited, and they have to move into a different setting because that provider has more than four, or has reached the limit of four, and that's concerning because of the consumer choice. So that is what I came to say, and I'm happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that the discussion has gotten us a little confused because the bill itself does not address anything related to the four persons sharing a housing unit. The bill only deals with the concentration of how many units in a building can be occupied by people with the same diagnosis. So this doesn't in any way address whether a corporate foster could go from four to five. It only addresses people who are using home and community-based services. So there's other funding streams with other types of programs. And so, this is a complicated area. I'm not in any way disparaging anyone because it's hard to understand all the rules that we have and all the MA funding streams that we have and all the laws that we have. The purpose of this law, as I see it, is to really prevent us from creating you know, sort of ghettos of concentrated people in communities that aren't really integrated into the community, which was the vision of closing the regional treatment centers and other large institutions, was to have people live in communities where they would interact with people who don't have their diagnosis, that it would be a normalized setting. Hopefully they would be able to hold jobs or interact in other parts of the community life. And so it's informed as well, not just by our own value system of who we think should needs to have that kind of option or not, but also by community zoning interests. I know there's city representatives here are concerned about things. We've had in the past some apartment buildings that have been fully filled with people with severe mental health issues, which was not the which is not what any of these witnesses have talked about. And so it was to prevent that sort of thing. And we do have the Olmstead Supreme Court ruling, under which we have to provide people living choices integrated into the community. We're not allowed to concentrate people, and we also have federal guidance that's evolving. And Heidi Hamilton from DHS could speak more in depth on that. We have had a stakeholders group that has involved providers, family members, advocates, and people are with these challenges that have been working on developing an Olmstead plan for Minnesota. They've been meeting for several months. They're doing a gaps analysis and really coming out with a comprehensive report. And I had given to Ms. Pignelli an amendment that I'd worked out with DHS that actually addresses them coming back out of that process involving everyone that's impacted with recommendations that would help us deal with this next year. The situation with Clare Housing and is that they actually have a very unique situation, and they have a current grandfather, and I added in some language that just still continues to make that grandfather that they have clear, which is they have been able to develop housing with a federal program called the Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS program, in which the federal money can only be used with housing that is diagnosis specific. So they can create these apartment buildings and for people who are living with HIV/AIDS, and only some of them in that unit might get to a point of illness in which they would then qualify for the waiver services. And so they have a unique challenge because they can't control the progress of the disease with the people who are there. They help people manage it. And so they have a unique situation that has been recognized with the grandfather and the amendment that Ms. Pignelli is drafting, and I had hoped would be here before we got to this, but it was listed originally later in the agenda. We'll address both of those. And so with the committee's indulgence and with Representative Dean's consideration, I would hope that when we got that amendment we could actually talk about that, because I think that will help everybody who's impacted move forward.
Right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Ms. Pugnelli's been ill, but I think is the – did I just see Ms. Cleveland walking with amendments?
Madam Chair, yes, but it's not to this bill.
Not to this bill.
She's working on them upstairs.
Oh, she is. Okay. All right. Well, Representative Dean, did you – okay. And we'll give Mr. Larson a chance as well. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and we advocate for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And at this time, we're opposed to House File 1395. We think it does need further discussion. Thank you, Representative Loeffler, for stealing most of my speech, so I don't have to repeat that. But I do want to say this is an instance in which I think we should look at individual cases rather than passing legislation that could impact the opportunities for up to 30,000 people. And the ARC is consistently in the position of supporting, looking at what the individual needs and pursuing housing in that way. And just to say again, I got the Olmstead Commission going. We've got the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that are very interested in this type of topic. And we just have the recent autism report that also addresses these issues. And just to close, the ARC Minnesota has a program called Housing Access Services, and in the past 3.5 years, we've helped 650 people find places of their own where their name is on the lease. So I think there are alternatives that we need here, and we need to have further discussions before we should pass this particular bill. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Larson. Okay, and yeah, members, what I'm thinking is that we might want to perhaps lay the bill on the table and take it up a little bit later when we have Representative Loeffler's amendment, because this does seem, and this this is a policy, obviously, where everybody is, everyone has the same goal, but it is a really a true policy conundrum of how do we get the law right so that we hit the sweet spot on this. And so I would like to, rather than just rushing to a vote on the bill at this point, since there is an amendment that Representative Loeffler wanted to offer. I don't know if Representative Dean has seen the amendment.
Representative Madam Dean? Chair, members, I have not seen the amendment, and my understanding is we'll be going to HHS Finance after this, and I'm more than happy to continue to work with Representative Loeffler and other folks to try to get this in the form that it achieves what I believe we're all trying to achieve. You know, as we've heard in testimony today, I mean, this affects many individuals with many different sort of needs relative to housing. So, you know, some groups may, you know, support this, some groups may be opposed to it, but I think ultimately we want to get to the point where those individuals have that choice and we have the right settings that work with certain individuals and their needs.
Right. Well, I appreciate that, Representative Dean, but Representative Loeffler has an amendment that's in process and seems like it's going to get here, and I'm not talking about laying it on the table and killing it by any means, just bringing it up a bit later in our hearing today, and maybe during the time you and Representative Loeffler could speak and you could look at the amendment, because this is the policy committee, and I know that Representative, we do pass some things on with the intention of continuing to work. There's no question about that, but since we've had the discussion here today, members are who are involved in this and interested in it are here, and we don't have complete overlap between the two committees, so you'd really be sort of starting from scratch with some members, and rather than make Representative Huntley bear the brunt of just pushing it all along to him, I think we should, if we can possibly make some progress today with what we've already heard and wrestled with, I think that would be the best thing, since we do have other matters on the agenda. So if you'd be amenable to that, and if any comments from members on that procedure, would everyone be amenable to our doing that, laying this on the table, and then we can pick it up? Representative Loeffler?
That's fine with me. I don't know if there's any other testimony that you'd want to take. I don't know if there's anyone else who wanted to testify, but otherwise I would really appreciate that.
All right. Well, we can take further testimony later on when we bring the bill back. And so Representative Loeffler, I would entertain a motion to lay the bill on the table. Temporarily?
Madam Chair.
All right. All right. Motion to lay the bill on the table temporarily. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay, the motion prevails. So the bill is laid on the table, and we will pick it up a little bit later. Oh, and here she is. But Representative Dean, go ahead, and you'll want to talk to Representative Loeffler and see the amendment anyway. So thank you. Okay. Okay. Let's take up House File 453, Representative Dorholt. Welcome to the committee. Representative Dorholt, I will move your bill. So I move that House File 453 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. So welcome. Would you like to go ahead and explain your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be provide for psychiatric consultation primary care practitioners, including licensed psychologists. And I do have a couple of testifiers with me here to speak on behalf.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill on the surface may appear to be just a request for payment of services, but it's so much more. It's an instrument for change. It reflects the core of our society's demand for higher quality health care with improved patient outcomes, greater efficiency, and improved quality of life. While it addresses mental health, it is mental health at the nexus with care for chronic illness. This bill creates one pathway to provide the integrated care that recognizes the needs of the whole person. Comorbidity between mental health, substance abuse, and chronic physical conditions is high, with 68% of adults with a mental disorder having at least one general medical problem, and 29% of those with a medical disorder reporting a mental health condition. It's estimated that 70% of primary care visits have a psychosocial driver. Mental health problems exacerbate the disability associated with physical disorders and complicate their management. Patients with such comorbidities consume high levels of medical care services and health care costs. The treatment of the whole patient with integrated care demonstrates improvement in outcomes and reduces utilization. Patients need assistance in integrating healthy behaviors into their overall lifestyle so they can be successful in managing their health. There are several models of integrated care, including consultation to primary care, co-location, and having a mental health professional fully integrated in the primary care team. This bill addresses the first model, consultation to the primary care provider. Having mental health professionals as an integrated part of the team is the ultimate goal, but it's not realistic for all settings, such as in rural areas, and for our stage of development in healthcare reform. New payment models are necessary to shift the face of healthcare delivery. Reimbursement for consultation for primary care providers and psychologists is a step in that direction. Not all patients are seen in healthcare delivery systems and accountable care organizations with integrated access to health psychology. To reach the goals set out in health reform, changes in payment for different models of integration are needed. I've been privileged to work in three different kinds of integrated settings in my career. I worked on a consultation liaison team for adolescents with chronic conditions. I was a fully integrated team member for serving individuals with cystic fibrosis. And I met with a community pediatrician to consult on common patient. These experiences have shown me the power of consultation by psychologists in improving healthcare outcomes. We ask that you carefully consider supporting this bill as a vehicle to move important health reforms forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dr. Tabitha Greer Reed. I'm a licensed psychologist and president of the Minnesota Psychological Association. I'm also here to testify so that psychologists can be paid for consultation to primary care providers. Psychologists actually have a long history in primary care settings at varied levels of integration. And while many behavioral health providers have collaborated within primary care settings, having a fully integrated practice is still pretty rare. But the importance of mental health in primary care settings has been increasingly recognized as critical to the quality and outcomes of medical treatment. Approximately 50% of all individuals with mental health disorders receive care by primary care providers, and this rate has actually increased in recent years. So psychologists are uniquely qualified, given our education and training, to consult with primary care providers. And we believe that payment for this service is crucial in order to further integration of care, but also for the well-being of people with chronic physical disorders like heart problems, asthma, diabetes, who have trouble with complying with their treatment. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are there questions from members? I have a question to either of the testifiers. Do private insurers cover these consultative services for psychologists? Ms. Stark?
Madam Chair, members, right now they do not. There are some payment methods to cover consultation, but it's not consultation by phone or email or those kinds of things. The patient must be in the room. Psychologists can use health behavior codes around specific illnesses such as asthma and diabetes, but there are limitations to that consultation.
And follow up on that, do they provide the consultative services for the psychiatrists?
Yes. Payment for consultation by psychiatrists is covered.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. One other testifier, welcome to the committee, if we could get you a chair. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ed Idy. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 453. As a statewide organization, we hear from consumers, family members, providers, and practitioners from all over the state about issues relating to service difficulties. They run the gamut from copays that are too high, lack of transportation to appointments, providers changed within networks, shortages of providers, etc. Anytime we can assist people to find appropriate services that are affordable and close to people's homes, we win. At a time when most people want to get healthier and a shortage and sometimes limitations on access to health care, any way that we can get more people options, it's a good thing, and this bill does that. In particular, relating to primary care, we were talking before the session started, and my mother's 96 years old and lives alone, and she had a health issue recently, and as we're talking with her, it was she seemed depressed. And so we talked about it with the doctor, and the doctor said, well, maybe you should be taking a mild antidepressant. And her whole, you know, she was talking about, why am I here? I'm 96 years old. Why am I around? Why I've lived too long, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, she changed her whole attitude of life. And it's, you can see that. And we talk to people around the state as to how important it is to get good consultation when decisions are made. As we enter an era of providing more health care to more people, we must look at viable options for everyone. You've been hearing a great deal about how much broader we can make, how we can be more inclusive in providing services. And in the newspaper this morning was a big article about cutting $150 million from Health and Human Services. We support bills like this, and then we cut the guts out of services, and it's a little bit frightening. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are there other testifiers on this bill? Anybody else who would like to testify for or against? Mr. Lehman, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. Tom Lehman, I'm appearing today on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. I'm just here to say this is a good bill, could be a great bill. By adding a few more providers, I think Ms. Stark and Mr. Ide laid a good foundation for the value of consultation. They're absolutely right, and that's why, as we look at consultation, physician assistants who provide mental health services, APRNs, LICSWs, LMFTs, who all serve the Medicaid population, should be part of this bill as well. But the bill moves in the right direction, raises the right issues. Consultation is valuable. It's important. We appreciate Representative Dorthold bringing it forward. And it could be a fantastic bill if we broaden it to make consultation available to all MA enrollees, not just those that are seen by a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. It could be Christmas in March. Representative Dorthold, well, let me just make a couple of comments on this bill. And when you look at this bill on its face, it appears to be just a finance bill because we are moving it to the Finance Committee. But I thought it was important to have the discussion because what we're talking about here is how payment shapes delivery of health care. And so it is really a policy issue, and we know that we as a state are trying to move in the direction of more collaboration. We are a very collaborative state in our medical systems, but that I think we all sort of share the value that the more collaboration you have, the better it is, that we're working toward different payment, how payment shapes delivery. And I think that's what this bill kind of highlights, that if you pay for something, you get more of it. And it is notable, however, that we don't have right now private payers paying for this, apparently, from what the testifier said. also, I'd kind of like to see, looking at the bill, as of 2006, we were paying for the psychiatrist consultations, and I'm kind of curious to see what results we've had from that, or what we know about the impact of that before we actually move on to add the psychologist consultations. Much as I like the idea and kind of philosophically think it would be a good idea, we don't know, of course, whether we can fund this. We don't know what the fiscal note will be. That's why we're sending it to Chair Huntley's committee. And, of course, as was mentioned, we do have a really low target, and that is really unfortunate. There are going to be many things that we think we should do that we think will save money in the long run that we're simply not going to be able to do this year. But that said, I appreciate your bringing this bill. I think it's a good discussion for us to have. And Representative Dorholt.
Thank you. For those of you who don't know, I am a mental health professional. I'm a counselor. I work at Central Minnesota Mental Health Center. I work specifically with adults who live with serious and persistent mental illness. I'll join your committee in a couple years, maybe. didn't want to touch the ACA this year, so sorry about that. but to your point, you mentioned we're good at collaborating, but collaboration is avoided because of things like this. And I agree with Tom, who was just up here. I would have loved to load this up with every single mental health professional, because in my world, some of us, whether we're LPCC or LMFT, we are our client's primary care provider. We know the client better than anyone else. And you mentioned the psychiatrist. For those of you who don't know, getting a hold of a psychiatrist is practically impossible unless they're down the hall from you. So the collaboration there is probably minimal because of the time allotted to psychiatrists, MD prescribers. But I think this is absolutely necessary. We cannot address mental health concerns with a medical-only approach, and it can't just be therapy. We know that when everything is all together, we get a much better outcome. First thing I do with my clients is I talk about physical health along with mental health, because it has to be together, and I think this is the best way to do it and get the ball rolling, so that collaboration between a medical model and a mental health models are more integrated. So I just want to say that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dorholt. Are there questions or comments from members? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 453 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dorholt. Let's take House File 1345, Representative Moran. And Representative Moran is going to move that House File 1345 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Okay, I am really honored to introduce this bill today. This House File 1395 is really a bill about maintaining a strong safety net. Because we don't want people to fall through the cracks, which is why we are creating a health exchange, why we are really enforcing the Affordable Care Act. It's why we do what we do to ensure that people are covered. So expanding MA and establishing a basic health plan will improve coverage options for low-income patients. However, 210,000 Minnesotans will remain uninsured after 2014. So similar experience from states like Massachusetts shows that safety net providers would end up with a larger proportion of the remaining uninsured. MA patients with lower reimbursement rates compared to other providers. So unless payment methods, funding, and other adjustments are made, the safety net providers who specialize in serving the most disadvantaged patients will be unable to keep up with the increased demand for their specialized services. So that's just a highlight of what this bill does. I'm going to refer to my testifier to go into more in-depth of this bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Scandrett. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, and really appreciate Representative Moran and the committee for hearing the bill today. The Safety Net Coalition is a group of nonprofit providers, or kind of unique providers, who have missions of serving the most disadvantaged people in Minnesota. So they have low income, uninsured, very diverse patient base. So again, they choose to serve the people who often have the most complex challenges in their lives and have special services and approaches to be sure and serve them. This includes mental health, dental, community health centers, some safety net hospitals, home care services, and so forth. The Safety Net Coalition is very appreciative of the work that's being done this session to expand Medicaid, to establish the basic health plan, and other things that you're working on. But as Representative Moran said, that even with those expansion, we're expecting that these nonprofit safety net providers are going to see a lot of increase in demand of the remaining uninsured, as well as more patients who have lower reimbursement because they're enrolled in state programs. And unlike other providers, they really don't have very many insured patients where they're receiving better reimbursement. So they not only have a more costly group of patients to serve because of their complexity, but they also have lower reimbursements for their public program patients, and also uninsured patients for whom there's no reimbursement at all. And so for many years, the safety net providers have been chronically underfunded, and at a point after many cuts in programs, of being in a very difficult situation right now. So what you have before us is a bill that what we've attempted to do is, knowing that your resources are limited, to bring recommendations for how you can target your resources to those both patients and providers who have the most need, who are the most vulnerable, the providers at risk of not being around to be the safety net, and the patients at risk of not getting care because they have many needs and many providers are unable to serve them because of the financial constraints. A number of the recommendations in the bill are came out of the governor's health reform task force. Unfortunately, they didn't make it into the governor's budget, so we thought they were good ideas and would bring them forward anyway. So you do have a summary, so I'm not going to go section by section, but I'll just highlight the key parts of the bill and then answer any questions you may have. One concept in the bill is called critical access payment rates. And the way critical access payment rates works is, for these types of providers who have very high concentrations of uninsured and Medicaid patients, the state has provided an extra payment bump for them. That's kind of both to address the higher complexity and needs of the patients, but also the fact that they don't have any private, very few privately insured patients. They don't have anywhere else to get the money from. So this bill had proposed to kind of enhance those rates for community health centers, community dental clinics, mental health providers, and home care services. Again, just targeted for those providers who specialize in serving these types of populations. Another requirement in here is, it's called essential community provider. This is an existing law that requires that these specialized providers be available to patients to choose them regardless of what health plan they're in, and we're just trying to extend that to the new Minnesota Care Basic Health Plan program as well. Another set of provisions in here relates to the health disparities that are experienced by racial and ethnic groups in Minnesota, trying to get better data to identify those disparities and then have greater input from those groups that experience those disparities in the development of programs on disparities. And then one new part of the bill that's in the author's amendment, there's some small pieces of it in the original bill, but the author's amendment expands it more, is the development of a safety net of the safety net, which is a program for all those uninsured people who will still remain uninsured after the Medicaid expansion and the insurance exchange. A more limited set of benefits. It has cost containment provisions incorporated in it, similar to some of the other reforms. But the idea is that regardless of the reasons for it, when very poor people need health care and don't have insurance, they still go get health care, and often the providers that are willing to serve them then get stuck with the uncompensated care. And this is designed to be sure that there is a safety net for everybody in the state. So I'm going to stop there. Again, you have a summary of the section by section. Many of these are budget provisions, and we're not under any illusions that all of this will get funded, but we'd like an opportunity to make the case in the Finance Committee and hope that, again, when resources are limited, we be sure that the neediest patients and the providers who serve them will be around to continue to serve them in the future.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Scandrett. And Representative Mack has a question, and then we have not moved the amendment. I didn't realize that was an author's amendment, the A1, but we'll do that after Representative Mack's question. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure, maybe to the author, maybe to the testifier, just a couple questions on clarification. As we've moved through the session, I find myself getting a bit confused from time to time on some of the various discussions we have around the uninsured, what that population will look like after the Medicaid expansion and the exchange and everything else. And I guess a couple of questions maybe to the testifier. If you could clarify just a couple of your statements. One thing that you mentioned was that the demand will drastically increase on the safety net hospitals. I guess I'm looking for some information why it will, what does drastic mean, I guess, and what does, why will that be occurring? As I'm looking through this handout that you sent out, and it talks about the remaining uninsured, and I guess I'm wondering, what does that population look like? It looks like you've got a lot of numbers. It looks like you've done your homework on this. What do those folks look like? And then the last part is you talked about the very poor people will end up at safety net hospitals that will end up with uncompensated care. My understanding going forward with the MA expansion, and we've talked about this quite a bit in our committees, that there really won't be such a thing as uncompensated care for the very poor anymore, because hospitals will have an assumed eligibility for MA. If they have somebody come through their doors, they can enroll them right then. So really, if everything we've been hearing over the last few months and years is accurate, that's virtually an impossible situation after 2014. And so if you could just give some clarifying statements, I'm frankly quite confused, and then I just have one more question after that.
Mr. Scandrett.
Madam Chair, I'll see what I can do to answer the question. There's several parts to the question. One part is the increased demand on safety net providers, and we're looking at what happened in Massachusetts in particular and some other states. What's likely to happen is that as there's an expansion, fewer and fewer providers are going to be willing to see the uninsured, and I'll get to that later. And so the experience is more and more of those uninsured will go to those providers whose mission is to not turn anybody away, regardless of their coverage. So more and more of the uninsured will end up being served by a smaller number of nonprofit safety net providers and hospitals. And so that's part of the demand. The other demand is with the Medicaid expansion, more patients will now go to some of those safety net providers with insurance, but they're being paid for at the Medicaid rates. And for many providers for whom Medicaid's a small percentage of their business, they do that as a community service, even though they may be losing money on those patients. But when most of your patients are Medicaid or uninsured, that increased demand isn't always a good thing if you are losing money, especially when those patients are more costly to serve than other patients. And then in terms of who the remaining uninsured are, there are some estimates of that. Nobody's really, I think, knows for sure who those people will be. But there are several categories. There are some who would be who would be poor enough to not be mandated to get coverage and would not be able to afford what they can get through the insurance exchange and not be eligible for the public programs because their income would be above the limits for the Medicaid eligibility. Another set of categories is that there are types of people for who are not eligible for Medicaid, even though they may be income eligible. One category is immigrant populations, including those who are documented immigrants who are in the country, but who under the conditions of their immigration are not eligible for the Medicaid program, and so they end up needing services. That's probably the largest category of patients that would remain in the uninsured category. So those are kind of the two categories, and I think people are still trying to figure out exactly what the uninsured will look like. But again, what we do know is that the more of those uninsured will be at a smaller number of safety net providers, number one, and probably the bigger concern is that the standard Medicaid rates for the patients who are going to the safety net clinics are inadequate without some additional critical access type of enhancements so that they're able to cover that. Otherwise, they're just not going to be able to continue to serve those low-income patients. And again, these aren't just providers who economically will accept patients. They're providers who offer unique services to them so that those really poor people or who face other barriers, they actually do more things for those patients in order to get them into the clinic and make sure that they can get healthy. So that's more expensive to serve those patients and then being paid lower than what other providers would be paid for their insured patients.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just a brief follow-up question to the bill. And I guess, and the one comment I guess that I would just challenge on what that uninsured population looks like, and I maybe have to draw myself a continuum with all the different numbers, but again, if I understand all of the things that both the federal government has done and what we're trying to do here at the state, between the MA expansion and the where you fall in the federal poverty guideline and what is available to you with that, then you go to our Minnesota Care program that we're hoping to pass as our basic health plan and the level of federal poverty guideline and what that brings you to, and then subsidies and tax credits that are available to you after that. It's quite the continuum of where you have access to public programs and tax subsidies to make health care affordable, which is the goal that has been purported by from our federal government all the way down to make sure that continuum is complete. So I guess if you're suggesting that there is still a major gap where folks can't afford this and they won't get a tax credit and maybe we've missed something in that goal, I guess I just challenge that premise. I see it as a pretty long continuum of trying to make it affordable for people and cover all the bases. And then just my final comment, this is probably to the author. I see some things in here on health disparities and trying to set policy decisions on page 2, and there's a few different places. And I think that's a really important goal, a laudable goal. The one thing I think we've heard a couple different bills that gets at health disparities, asking the departments to look at how we report on these things, who's collecting it, getting input. This seems to be one of a few different things, and I guess I'm just concerned that we're going to have a lot of different things that we're asking the department to do in different bills. There might be overlap, and it could lead to inefficiency. And instead of just having one health disparity bill or proposal that's just really clear, I think in another bill we're creating a council specifically for health disparities in the minority populations. I guess I just, you know, caution us as legislators and in the committee process, if we could just have one clean system in terms of how we want to move forward on that goal, I have a feeling we'll be much more successful in achieving the goal versus having a lot of different pots and things going on all over the place in different bills. I'm not sure what we're actually accomplishing. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Representative Mack. I think that's one of the challenges of our system here, that we do things by bill. And so we get different ideas from different members, and I think as things do move through the process, there is a process of kind of winnowing things down, but hopefully by the time they get to the floor, we've got things collected, and I think that since this is going to the Finance Committee, I think whatever pieces of this Representative Huntley's committee is able to fund will probably be brought together in the finance bill.
Madam Chair, thank you
for that. Representative Moran.
I would like to, in agreement with you, to say that as we compile all these bills that have been introduced, there may be some overlaps. But I can say clearly within any of the health disparities bills, I have not seen a council, which I think a cultural and ethnic council is really needed to bring that perspective to the table in consultation with the commissioner.
All right, thank you. And other questions for members or comments on this bill? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Okay, not seeing any. And I just also want to make a comment, maybe Mr. Scandrett, while you're still at the table. You know, some of these criticisms of the Affordable Care Act, it doesn't cover everybody, there are still gaps and all of that. I have to say that many of us who supported the exchange very strongly, which I did and was even on the conference committee, and as everybody knows, was a strong proponent of having a strong health exchange, insurance exchange, and a strong proponent of implementing the federal law that we have, that is the law that we need to implement as best we can. I've never claimed that this was the ideal solution to our health care conundrum. And what it does is try to make the insurance model work better than it has. And that's really all it does. And I've never been somebody who thinks that health insurance is the way we ought to connect patients to health care. So just keep that in mind. There are gaps. No question about it. It will not be a perfect solution. Nobody ever claimed that it will. The Affordable Care Act itself is a grand compromise. And I view it in a lot of the pieces of it are an attempt to keep health insurance in the game. And that was not a given. And so just to say that, it's a compromise. And like all compromises, it's nobody's dream. And it's going to be, there are going to be parts that we're going to have to keep adjusting and working on and trying to do the best to make sure that people in our state who need health care can get the care that they need at an affordable price. So nobody here is claiming that we have a perfect system. Yeah, and so Madam, Representative Moran, final words on your bill?
So, Madam Chair, so just for the record, let me also say that I strongly support the Affordable Care Act in exchange. And all that we are doing here to ensure that we are creating a process where as many people as possible can be covered. Because what we do know is that the process that is in place currently is not working. And so our goal here is to work to do the best we can to cover as many people as possible. But this bill is just another place of saying that with the possibility that there will be gaps and that with a community clinic that is in my community, Open Cities, who do a wonderful job of just taking people in who are uninsured, underinsured, and uninsured, that they get the treatment that they need, and then how can we also be watchful as to how we can also support those entities of those group of people. So my hope is that we can take this bill and pass it on to our challenge House and Human Service Finance Committee and see how we can do that work there.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. And, oh, we did not adopt the A1 amendment. Yes, so Representative Moran moves the A1 amendment. Is there any further discussion to the amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And then Representative Moran is going to move that House File 1345 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe not. Okay. All right, we'll do 1654. Let's see.
Sure. Whatever I can do to help.
Madam Chair, welcome to your committee, and I understand you're going to present House File 1604 for Representative Abler.
Yes,
and you?
Mr. Chair, right, and there's been a little last-minute moving around on this bill. I, in fact, am now the chief author of the bill, I believe.
So then Representative Liebling moves that House File 1604 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have, there is an amendment in your packets. I think this is the DE1, which I'd like to move the DE1 to put the bill in the form in which I'd like to discuss it. And actually, I have, before we do that, Mr. Chair, I have an oral amendment to the DE1, which I'd like to incorporate into that. And I think staff has this. In fact, I believe it's being typed up, but I just like to give this to committee members as well, of course, and incorporate it into my amendment, and then I'll let everybody know what we're doing here.
So, Representative Liebling, do we need to adopt the DE1 first and then make an amendment to the amendment, or are we good to go with the...
Mr. Chair, I think the way to do it is I'll give you the oral amendment and I'll incorporate that into my DE1, and then if we could adopt the DE1 with the incorporation.
Okay, go ahead with your...
That's how we can do it.
Your amendment.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So members, at the very end of the DE1, before the period, we're going to insert these words. And it's a little bit long, so I apologize, but we do have it in writing, and we'll I think staff has it. So the words are, or if the knowledge was obtained in the course of a professional patient relationship, if the patient is licensed or regulated by a health licensing board. So let me give that to you one more time. I know it's, I apologize, a little long, but so at the end of the amendment, before the period, we're going to insert the words, or if the knowledge was obtained in the course of a professional patient relationship, if the patient is licensed or regulated by a health licensing board. And members, as we discuss this, I think you'll get a better sense of what we're trying to do here. So, Mr. Chair, if I could incorporate that into the DE1, and then I'd like to move the DE1 with that incorporation.
Okay. Representative Liebling moves the DE1 amendment with the oral amendment to her amendment, and that was on line 1.16, correct? Then
correct.
Just to clarify. And then does anybody have any questions on clarity as to what words were added to the amendment?
Repeat it. Chair, could we just read it one more time?
So maybe staff, if you have it, would you go ahead and repeat the, or Chair Liebling, if you would read the amendment one more time.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair. I will. At the very end, on line 1.16 before the period, the words are, or if the knowledge was obtained in the course of a professional-patient relationship, if the patient is licensed or regulated by a health licensing board.
Representative Ward? Okay. All right. Chair Liebling renews her motion to adopt the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? No? Motion carries. All right, Representative Liebling, to your bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for your indulgence, members. This is one of those bills that came to us late. It was originally Representative Abler's bill. He couldn't be here today. And then I said I would present it for him, and then there came to be some people sort of, as you know how it happens, people kind of started to pay attention, and we heard there were some difficulties with the language. And I think with this DE1, as we have adopted it now, we've kind of smoothed out all the bumps from stakeholders. So members, this is a really important issue, and I thought when it came to my attention that it was something that we really did need to make sure that we took up this year and moved it forward, and that is that, as you know, as you may have read in the press, there's been a problem in our state with diversion of narcotics and controlled substances from healthcare institutions. And this is I hope it's not a growing problem. I can't say for sure it isn't, but my testifier, I'm sure, will address that. But So this is, at its core, what this bill does now is to make sure that when this occurs, when a person who's a licensed professional subject to one of the health licensing boards, like a nurse or a physician or others, when the institution becomes aware that there's been a diversion of narcotics or other controlled substances, that they now will report that to the appropriate licensing board. So up until now, there was no requirement to report, and the licensing boards, although other people might know about it, the licensing boards were not aware of it and couldn't track this across different employers or different situations. So that's the essence of the bill. And what we've done here, that last language was just language that exempts from the reporting any knowledge that was obtained where the professional is a patient. That's how I understand this. So if a nurse has some substance abuse issues and the that nurse's physician finds out in the course of taking care of that patient, that would not be reportable. That's how I'm understanding what this amendment does. This last amendment came, I think, from the MMA. So with that, and if anybody's unhappy with it, I'm sure we'll hear from them in the course of this hearing. But with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Dr. Berg.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Berg, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
All right. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Dr. Keith Berg. I'm an anesthesiologist from the Mayo Clinic, currently serve as vice president of the Board of Medical Practice. In my career at Mayo, I chair the Medication Diversion Prevention Committee, and unfortunately, it is a growing problem. This bill really had its genesis in a Trib article about 2 years ago about a nurse that had relapsed to fentanyl addiction three times, was endangering patients in the process, and the nursing board never heard about this individual. So this is an attempt to fix a gap in the current system, whereby employers can satisfy the reporting requirement in the law by reporting to the Health Professional Services Program, HPSP. And HPSP is basically forbidden to report to the boards when they become aware of a diversion for self-use. This does not in any way alter the reporting requirements for HPSP or the confidentiality of HPSP. Does nothing to HPSP, but it would put the onus on the employer that recognizes drug diversion, which is a felony level theft, to be reported to the responsible health licensing board. In the Twin Cities newspapers 2 days ago was a dramatic story out of St. Cloud of patients that came to harm, one of whom died from a nurse that was diverting Dilaudid there. I think there are several other just gruesome examples of how bad this problem can be. In the Colorado, 36 patients were infected with hepatitis C by a fentanyl-diverting radiation technologist. Currently evolving on the East Coast right now, in New Hampshire, there have been 32 patients infected by hepatitis C in a fentanyl-diverting healthcare employee. Unfortunately, this person worked in 8 other states and 15 other institutions, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of patients across the country that are getting letters saying they need to be tested for hepatitis C because they've been exposed to this person. Tragically, this person was terminated from 3 different jobs when he was caught stealing fentanyl, including at one point being found in a bathroom stall, unconscious, with a fentanyl syringe floating in the toilet bowl next to him. There was no reporting requirement. There was no place to report to because this person wasn't really a licensed individual. But it gets to the point that if these people aren't reported, they can move on and keep doing this, and they will keep doing this. If the employer just terminates their employment and the boards don't hear about it, it continues to put patients at risk. And this is an attempt to make certain that an employer that becomes aware of this must report it. They can report it to HPSP as well, but they must report it to the board. And to say again, there are those who would say this is somehow criminalizing a medical problem. I think that's an absurd thing to say, and that I think everybody in this room, I would offend their intelligence if I were to suggest that theft of controlled substances is somehow not a crime. It is. It's a felony-level crime. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Any questions, members? We do have one. Representative Doctor, if you just hang tight, Representative Fritz has a question.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I have some concerns. In my life as a nurse, we have caught people doing this, and we have had people self-report, and this is an ongoing problem in the profession, doctors and nurses. It isn't all nurses. And my concern is kind of a double jeopardy thing here. If, getting the employer, involved in turning in the nurse, and then having the employer involved in the more or less the civil part of this, losing your license, and not that I my fear is there's a gap where the nurse will not get the help that she needs. And I do have a testifier that I would like to come down if you would so indulge me in this. We believe in self-reporting. We believe in therapy and in treatment, and we would like to encourage that, continue to encourage that all the more. However, I am concerned about the double jeopardy and the fear of that on that nurse. So if I could have someone.
Dr. Berg, thank you for taking time to come to St. Paul today. And ma'am, please introduce yourself, and thank you for coming, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Ledger. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. I believe you all have a letter jointly from us as well as SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Our concerns about this issue is that we believe strongly in healthcare professionals' ability to self-report when they are diverting drugs as part of a substance abuse problem. There is a separate problem when healthcare professionals are diverting for the purposes of selling drugs. We certainly don't condone that by any means, but we do believe chemical dependency is an illness that requires treatment, and we've been long supporters of the Health Professional Services Program, which allows nurses to get early intervention as well as the ongoing treatment that they need to actually go back to their professions and become successful parts of the healthcare team. We also think this is a problem that affects a very small number of healthcare professionals. It's by no means something that is occurring on a regular basis. There certainly are sensational cases. Our main concern about this is that when a nurse does enter HPSP, that he or she would then engage in a treatment plan that allows him or her to continue to work, but that part of that treatment plan might involve reporting back to their employer that they did divert drugs. Often as part of a treatment plan for chemical dependency, part of the healing process or the treatment process for the individual is that they are required to sort of atone for the things that they have done as part of their substance abuse problem. So our concern is that then the employer would know, the employer would then report them to the licensing board, and the nurse would be subject to punitive measures through the Board of Nursing when ultimately the goal is treatment and to get the employee back on his or her feet. So that's our main concern. We want to encourage self-reporting. We want to encourage the use of the HPSP, but certainly don't condone employees stealing drugs in order to sell them, or if the employee doesn't self-report, we don't condone that either.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Are there Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I don't think I got the letter, or didn't, but anyway, I appreciate the concerns that are expressed. I think, though, that what the bill is doing, and what maybe Mr. Berg can, Dr. Berg would want to weigh in on this again, I don't know, but I think that this is simply that the board should have knowledge of it. It doesn't require the board or change the way the board would handle this. So I'm thinking that in the situation that was discussed where, the say, a nurse, but again, this is not meant to focus on nurses. This can be physicians. It can be any licensed professional in the healthcare field. When that person comes back to work, and if their employer is then going to report, it's just a report. It doesn't have the board taking any action. It doesn't require any action. So I think that some of the concerns might be concerns. I don't know if people have concerns about how boards handle the knowledge. I think that might be a separate issue here. But to me, this bill is just simply saying that the board needs to just be aware, and that's all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling.
Ms. Ledger.
I think the main concern is that when a nurse, or any healthcare professional, certainly I'm here only speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, but that when they believe that they may be subject to any kind of report to any licensing board, that would discourage self-reporting. It's obviously a very scary place. You're in the midst of a disease. We want to make that, we want to do as much as we can to encourage self-reporting. And I think even if the nurse knows that it may only be a report, that is an additional measure that might discourage self-reporting.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think that when you report it to the board of nursing, they get that information, then they act. I mean, there's a cause and an action, and there would be reason for that, and could be an issuance of a conditional license or some sort of or removal of the license. So I hope that in the future we should work with the board, because I don't want to discourage people from self-reporting, and I think that, but I do think that there is a cause and action there with any board that would have to do due diligence in this. So there is a added penalty and discouragement, I see it. So just wanted to put that out there.
Ms. Ledger, could you tell me, or maybe just explain to the committee, is there a process in place right now, or Representative Liebling, that when a medical professional, this does happen, A, we make sure that they get guided toward treatment as well, too, if it's an abuse issue versus sales, and then how that works now, and I also think, from an employer perspective, I can understand the concern, because if I found out there was three other instances from three different institutions where this person was let go, and then you couldn't find this out, and they failed treatment or couldn't be rehabilitated, as a member of the public, I think I would be a little bit disappointed. So can you help alleviate my concerns with the way things are right now to tell me why we shouldn't maybe move toward a touch more mandatory reporting?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently, if a nurse self-reports and enters the health professional services program, then that professional is not subject to punitive action against him or her. That's what we want to continue to encourage. If the nurse or the other health professional is actually caught by the employer while diverting, I think that's a separate issue. We share your concerns. I mean, we certainly don't condone drug diversion by any means, but we would like to protect the ability of the nurse to self-report. In addition, there is mandatory reporting already when a vulnerable adult is placed in jeopardy. So we believe that there is some legislation already that exists that protects the vulnerable patient.
Dr. Berg, do you have some input on this?
Well,
I'm sorry,
Mr.
Representative Liebling.
There is another testifier who might be able to shed some light on this
okay.
as well.
Is that Ms. Bowe?
He's here for questions, so
sorry.
Maybe we could.
Please introduce yourself for the record. And
thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Williams. I'm a public member of the Board of Nursing and the Board of Pharmacy, and I serve as vice president of both boards this year. And both the Boards of Nursing and the Board of Pharmacy voted unanimously to support this bill. The two boards license and regulate more than 135,000 nurses and pharmacists in the state of Minnesota. That's more than half of all the health licensed professionals in the state of Minnesota. And the job of the boards is to protect the citizens of the state of Minnesota to ensure that these licensed health professionals are safe to practice. And it's vitally important to these boards for us to fulfill our mission that if an employer has knowledge that a health licensed professional is diverting drugs at work, that that information be shared with the board so we can take appropriate action. Being reported to the board is not necessarily going to result in punitive action. Our job is to investigate and see if the nurse or the pharmacist is safe to practice. And what we often do is refer that person to HPSB so they can be monitored and returned to practice. But it's important that the boards know this information. This bill does not prohibit anyone from voluntarily self-reporting to HPSB and confidentially enrolling in the program. This bill simply requires the employer to report that knowledge. We're simply asking that these two boards have the information to do the job that you've assigned to us, which is to protect the public by ensuring nurses and pharmacists are safe to practice.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Yes. Representative Liebling, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What I think I heard from the testifier from the Minnesota Nurse Association is a concern that we might be able to accommodate with some additional language. This bill is really a work in progress, I guess. But as I understood her concern, she seems to be worried about somebody who self-reports to their employer, and then their employer has to turn around and report to the board. And maybe that, you know, we can have some discussion offline here, and maybe we could take care of that particular situation.
I think we can. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the comment goes to the issue: if somebody self-reports or is referred by the board to HPSP, and they're deemed safe to go back to practice while they're being monitored, the program requires a on-site supervisor to make sure that that licensed professional is fulfilling their participation agreement with HPSB. And I'm certain that we would be willing to agree to language that would allow a licensed health professional who self-reports, not sent there by their employer, but self-reports to HPSB and is returned to work with this program where there's a worksite monitor, that relationship should not have to be reported to the board. I think we can accommodate that concern, and that would allow self-reporting to remain in place, but then provide the board with employer knowledge of drug diversion.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Representative Fritz?
I agree. Sounds good.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
Dr. Berg?
Mr. Chair, if I can just make one brief comment. Mr. Williams and I both serve on the HPSP program committee. We're deeply committed to the HPSP model. We're deeply committed to their mission. We would love to promote self-reporting at any time, and we don't want to change that at all.
All right. Well, with that, if there's no further questions, Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 1604 be recommended pass and placed in the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
We're going to take up House File 1156. Representative Fritz moves that House File 1156 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm back again with another try at trying to reduce some of these fees that our parents are paying. This is the parental fee bill that I've had before the committee, and I've had testifiers, other parents here who are paying these fees, and I basically it's a very small ask. We just want to go back to the 2010 rates. So, but I do have a parent here today who could speak to the fees that parents pay, and then I also have Steve Larson who could give us a brief overview of the bill itself. So I'll turn it over to them.
Before you do that, Representative Fritz, actually, this is along with in my mission, my continuing mission to sort of educate the committee members about some of these issues that are policy issues that we don't know much about sometimes, especially for the newer members on this committee. I asked Mr. Chun if he could sort of give us a very brief sort of overview of what we're talking about there. I'm sorry. Oh, that was the door. Oh, sorry. Okay, I guess I made a mistake there. It was a different bill that I had asked him to. But what I'd like to do, and I don't know if this is, maybe this would be Ms. Pugnelli's area more, and she isn't here. Or
Madam Chair, I could channel.
You could channel them? That would be great. Actually, Mr. Larson, thank you for that, because this is an area where we don't, Representative Fritz, when we just sort of start talking about parental fees, some of us know what we're talking about, but I suspect that many of us don't have a clue what we're talking about here. So I just wanted to sort of start with some general words about what are we talking about here? What is this area of law, and what does this do? So, Mr. Larson, if you could do that for us, that would be terrific.
Madam Chair, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and we advocate for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And thank you for hearing this bill today. Just a real brief history, and this goes along with the theme of this legislative session of giving access to health care for all Minnesotans. In about 1990, Minnesota passed legislation, sometimes known as TEFRA, which allowed children who were eligible for medical assistance because of their disability to access that medical assistance. Some of you might remember during the Ronald Reagan presidency era, he authored the Katie Beckett bill, which allowed this type of thing to happen, and states had an option of doing that. So children with middle class parents as far as income could enroll their child in medical assistance to get the types of services that are not available in regular health insurance programs, such as personal care attendance, expanded use of therapies, that type of thing. And along with that, in order to make that financially feasible in Minnesota, eventually there was put on a parental fee on a sliding fee scale, so that in addition to paying for their insurance through their employer or individually, families had to pay a slight fee in order to access this medical assistance for their child with disabilities. Those fees have increased over the years, and most dramatically in the past 10 years. And there's 8,000 now families now receiving services or on medical assistance because of the TEFRA law that allowed this. And there would be more if the fees weren't so high, and we represent those individual or those families that haven't been able to access medical assistance because they cannot afford the parental fees. Madam Chair, was that a good enough summary, or would you like any more information?
I think so. Thank you very much, Mr. Larson. I'm sure if members have questions about that, they'll ask as we go along, but I appreciate that overview. And with that, Representative Fritz, please continue.
And I do have a testifier that would even in, please accentuate that a little more. So.
Good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Leslie Cellini, and I currently reside in Ramsey County. My husband and I have been married for 13 years, and we have three beautiful children, Cassandra, or Cassie, 27, Christopher, 23, and Sean is 12, and Sean was born with Down syndrome. We didn't know Sean had Down syndrome until he was 5 days old. The doctor noticed a little bend in his pinky finger. So after some numerous blood tests we were run, we were sent home, and the last words we heard from the doctor, excuse me, were, "Don't worry. I really don't think he has Down syndrome." The next day we got the call, and the doctor quietly said, "The test came back positive. Your child has Down syndrome." It threw us into a tailspin. It's at that point when we realized that our life plan had forever changed. The fear of the unknown hit us hard. We didn't know anything about the disability, but we moved forward, and now we can't imagine life without him. We are very blessed to have Sean in our lives. After 11 years, we decided finally Sean needed some additional resources, resources that we couldn't give him. This is the reason our family finally made the decision to contact the county and look into options to help Sean become more comfortable with others and to learn to trust others. We always thought we could do it on our own, but we now realize that we can't, and having Sean feel this way isn't healthy for him or our family. After filling out what felt like hundreds of papers, Sean was finally granted medical assistance 5 months later. When we received our first invoice from the county, it took our breath away. Our bill was nearly $8,000. This is double what our private insurance deductibles are. And I do want to add that the county requires parents to carry their private insurance in addition to MA, so we have those fees along with the parental fees. It just doesn't make any sense. After seeing the high fees charged for mandated services that my vulnerable child requires to live safely in our community, it made our hearts sink for our family. It went from elation that we finally took this step in Sean's life to total deflation. Thoughts of "what have I done" started going through my head. Here I thought I was doing something great for our entire family, not just for Sean. When in reality, it has caused more stress on my family. It's just one vicious circle. Having to pay high fees just because Sean was born with a disability is absolutely devastating. The response from my the response from the county to my concerns over the high parental fee was, if there's not any ability to reduce the fees, we can certainly have a conversation about the pros and cons of staying on medical assistance. In my eyes, that's not the answer. We're not looking to quit, but to find a solution to what works for everyone. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened, so along with many people in my community, we may be forced to drop MA due to the stress of the high fee, leaving us back to square one. All the hard work we have done up to this point is great, but any outlook for additional care in the future is looking bleak. And why should Sean pay the price for this? He is the one who will suffer the most if we are forced to drop MA. As you know, people are struggling day to day to make ends meet, and people really shouldn't have to choose between getting much-needed services for their child and buying groceries or fixing their car so they can get to work. My husband and I have worked very hard in our life to get where we are today, and we feel we are some way punished for that success. We don't make a lot of money, but we were getting by. I now understand why many families are forced to go down to one-income families in order to make their son or daughter receive the care they need. However, parental providers are paying the price too. Some find the only way to survive caring for a child with special needs is to be the primary caretaker for that child. They quit their professional jobs to become caretakers, making just over $13 an hour. However, half of that does go back to the state to cover that parental fee that's charged. My son Sean wants to work, and he wants to go to college. He has many, many dreams. He doesn't want to sit around and see life pass him by. Excuse me. This is why this program was designed, to help those who need it. Obviously, there are more expenses to raising a child with special needs, so these services would be beneficial to families and help them acquire the tools they need to ensure their child succeeds. If we give them the tools to succeed, they will become much more independent. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Fritz, any other testifiers?
No, I don't have any other testifiers. And I just, I'm thinking back to the years that I've been here, and I remember sitting right where you are when I was a freshman, I think, or our first time in leadership. And The room was full of people whose parental fees had increased and caused bankruptcy to some. And they kept coming to us, and they were so polite, begging us to do something about this. And we're still at it. And all we're asking now is to delete what happened in 2011. And we're looking for, what, $1.2 million would is the ask. And delete that language that expires in June 30th, I believe.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Larson.
What we're trying to do with this legislation, as Representative Fritz described it, is the current legislation is good through 2015. We're trying. The only thing we're doing is deleting that date and putting in June 30th, 2013, so that increase would go away or sunset at that particular time. The total cost to family, additional cost to families over the past 2 years because of the increase passed in 2011 was $1.2 million. Half of that goes to the federal government. And according to state staff, the fiscal note for this particular bill would probably be around $600,000.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Larson. And of course, this is the policy committee. And so what I just wanted to, I'm not seeing other members with questions yet, but I just wanted to ask the testifier, Ms. Silani, or maybe Mr. Larson. So just to clarify, now these are families who, in fact, have private insurance, but the private insurance is not covering these kinds of costs that are necessary to take care of a child with disabilities. And I wonder if you could just be sort of explicit about where does the private insurance end, and what are the kinds of costs that are not covered that puts families in this situation? Because, again, it's another conversation that we've, like one we've had here this morning, about what are the limits of the private insurance system, and what is the public being asked to take on here when people, in fact, are carrying their own insurance? Mr. Larson?
Madam Chair and committee members, as I described before, some of it is personal care assistance services. Some of its therapies. A number of the individuals that pay the parental fee are also on waiver services, so they receive the types of services through that, home modifications, those types of things to help the individual with disabilities stay in their parental home. So it's, like as you described, it's those services over and above which currently exists in the private market, and the families go on to this because they're desperate to get access to those additional therapies, supports, respite services, so that their child can continue to live it in home, in their home.
Okay, thank you. All right, any other questions for members? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 1156 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you,
Madam
very much.
Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, there's someone here. Oh. Where is he? Oh, there he is. It's Representative Huntley. Oh.
He's got it.
He's okay. So far. Welcome to the committee, Representative Huntley. And members, I just want to let everybody know that this bill was scheduled, but we in fact do not have possession of the bill. This is House File 978. And so we will not be taking formal action today, but since it was on the agenda, and this is our last regularly scheduled meeting, I thought that we should take the opportunity to discuss the bill, have the presentation, take questions from members, and then at some later time we will have another meeting and take amendments and vote on the bill. So thank you for your indulgence on this, members. Representative Huntley, to your bill.
Madam Chair and the members, for those members that don't understand, this bill has already been to Commerce, and the Commerce Committee and the Commerce Department regulates regular insurance plans. But the Health Department regulates HMOs. So there's two different departments. And so anything involved with health insurance usually ends up going to Commerce and to the Health Committee. What this bill does is simply adapt Minnesota's current insurance laws to fit with the Affordable Care law that was passed in Washington. If we don't pass this bill, then the federal laws will trump what we have in our textbooks, so the or our law books. So the intent of this bill is simply to adjust our laws so that they fit the federal laws. The big advantage for us to do that is that we can then enforce the federal laws here in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and we won't have to rely on Washington to do that. There's many things, and we have two testifiers here, Manny Munson-Regala and Alyssa Van Ruden, and she's from Commerce, he's from Health, and they can explain the details of the bill, but I don't, as I said, basically we have to do this. And I don't think it was took me 5 minutes in the Commerce Committee. So I'll turn it over to the two testifiers.
All right. Who's first? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Van Root.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'll just do a brief walkthrough of some of the high-level bullet points of what this bill does. As Representative Huntley noted, this is to align our state law with the Federal Affordable Care Act. It includes a combination of changes that are already in effect in the market, but that our state law may not already align with, and then also changes that will go into effect January 1, 2014.
And could I just interrupt you for a second? And people in the audience, that buzzing you hear is somebody's cell phone interfering with our sound system. So if you would please turn off your cell phones. Some people's phones do that and others don't. But if you think it could be you, please shut it off. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Alyssa Van Ruden. I'm the Health Policy Advisor with the Department of Commerce. So I'll start by just going through the bullet points of the things that are already in effect in law and then the ones that are in effect January 1, 2014. It'll be just a brief summary, and then we'll be happy to take questions. The protections that are already in effect include dependent coverage for children up to age 26 on their parents' plan. Pre-existing condition exclusion for kids are no longer allowed right now. There are limitations on rescission of coverage, or basically retroactively canceling coverage or taking away coverage. Coverage for emergency services is not allowed without pre-authorization, so we needed some changes in law without that. There are no more lifetime or annual benefit limits. Full coverage for preventive care is already in effect, including several women's health provisions along with that. There's some changes to the appeals and external review processes for consumer complaints, both at the health carriers and at the state level. Yes. The rate review transparency is live already. The rates that are filed with the Department of Commerce need to be filed and public now under the federal law as well in certain circumstances. And then the uniform summary of benefits and coverage form that are already happening. So this is a summary document that goes along with any policy that you get. So starting January 1, 2014, there will be a number of other provisions, including guaranteed issue and renewability, so you can't have pre-existing condition limitations for anybody on a policy. Essential health benefits are now required, as well as the metal levels or actuarial value levels of insurance plans. Premium rate variations are limited to three specific things. You can vary premium rates based on geographic area, tobacco use, or age. Cost sharing and out-of-pocket limits are limited. So, for instance, small group employers can only have a $2,000 deductible and a $4,000 out-of-pocket limit. And specific benefit dollar limits are also prohibited now under the ACA. And then the last one is just a grace period extension for payment of premiums if you have a qualified health plan. So this is something that's specific to the exchange, but that would go into effect January 1.
All right. Thank you. We have a question from Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm so sorry, to the testifier from the Commerce Department, my ears perked up, you know, as a woman myself. Could you just tell me the women's health provisions in this bill that would affect I mean, could you lay out in detail what that is? I'm curious.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Franson, the women's health provisions have to do with some preventive care services that the ACA requires for some specific groups. So in state law, we actually already did have direct access to obstetrics and gynecological care, but we needed to do some technical cleanup to make sure that it aligned with the provisions of the ACA. This also included, on a federal level, inclusion of benefits that may or may not have been covered at 100% before. One of the examples of that includes mammograms or PAP tests and some other women's health testing services.
Thank you. Representative France.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One more question. Would that include abortion?
Ms. Von Rudin.
Madam Chair, Representative France, and that would not be on that list generally.
Other questions for members? All right. Mr. Munson-Bragalef, you want to continue?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Manny Munson-Bragalef in the Department of Health. Just wanted to share with the committee, we've been working very closely with the stakeholders, Council of Health Plans, the Insurance Federation, consumer advocates, working through the bill. As you can imagine, with a number of technical conformity changes, folks have been very helpful in saying we've cited the wrong provision or there could be some clarification. So we continue to work with them. We will likely bring to you when the bill is heard a couple of more technical amendments to, again, get the bill clearer and tighter.
All right. Thank you very much. Another more proof of the governor's statement that none of us is as smart as all of us, right? Yeah. So, terrific. Okay. Other questions, members? All right. Not seeing any. Thank you very much, and we'll look forward to voting on the amendments and the bill on another day. Thanks. Okay. All right. Representative Dean, I think we're ready to have you back here. And so I would move that we take 1395 off the table. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. And House File 1395 is back before us. And if members recall, we laid this on the table so that we could get Representative Loeffler's amendment and allow the author to have some discussion. Okay, and members, before we go on, too, I've been reminded 978, that's in your packets, which is the bill we just heard. It's a lot of paper there, so if you would please save that, put it back in the green jacket, and put it back in your folder, that would... that will save a few trees, and for those of you who want to stick it to northern Minnesota, they won't have as much business in the logging industry because of that. I expected a laugh from that because the Iron Rangers are always telling us that the paper helps their industry up north.
I'm all about jobs.
Okay. All right, Representative Dean, thank you for your patience. And so I see that there is now an amendment here. And Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment, which is just being distributed right now. And I'll tell people what this does in the context. Just remember, this is the bill that's dealing with what percent of an apartment building can be people receiving home and community-based waiver services with a whole variety of disability challenges in their lives. And the first part of the amendment reinstates current law, which is that it can't be more than 25%. Then it provides the exception that I had mentioned earlier, which is under federal law, which is deals with the CLAIR housing situation where the Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS program allows them to have segregated by diagnosis housing. And when people become more ill as their disease progresses, they can't really totally control the total numbers of people who would qualify for the waivers. And this would allow them to continue to do those services and expand. And then Section 2 is really the heart of the amendment and tries to deal with both the the Supreme Court Olmstead ruling and the fact that the federal government is in the process of developing regulations in this area about what you can't, how many people of what types of diagnosis can be clustered together. And so the Department of Human Services has been engaged over the past few months in a very active process to develop an Olmstead plan and to involve the stakeholders and the advocates and everybody in determining that. And what this amendment would do is say that they will have a very open and a participatory process with even a broader group, including advocates, providers, and city representatives in reviewing those studies and recommendations before bringing back to us in February 2014 a recommendation on how to be consistent with federal law and the court's rulings and to deal with addressing an exception process as is mentioned in 1.13, because we know one size doesn't fit all with all these different groups. And so they really do need to look at it in more depth than I think we have time to deal with today. And so, and originally I was told that this is agreed to by the Department of Human Services, the cities, the advocates for people with mental health and developmental disabilities, and the provider groups. There may still be some ideas that people want to have further consideration on.
Okay. Representative Dean, did you want to comment on the amendment?
There has been lots of discussion here this morning, and I am amenable to this particular amendment. However, I believe that I would like to possibly make some changes, but it can't happen until after this is adopted because it reinstates some language that's currently existing that has been stricken.
Okay. So is there anybody, are there questions to the amendment? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if any of the people who testified on this bill earlier had any testimony or comments about this particular amendment that we have in front of us now.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. I was just going to call for that, and I called on you first. So great minds think alike. Right. Is there anybody here who'd like to testify on the amendment? Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And please restate your name.
Lee Lewis, Executive Director of Clare Housing. Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, I will just say that I am comfortable with the changes that are being suggested.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Anybody else? Okay, not seeing anybody. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure what this does, because the bill as written greatly concerned people in my area. Basically, what we're doing is allowing something like Clare Housing to go ahead. Is that correct? Because I've been at neighborhood meetings where we approved Clare Housing. So, but most of the other things won't go ahead until it comes back to the legislature. Is that basically what this does then?
Well,
or maybe it's
Representative Mullery, yeah, I think you might have missed some of our discussion earlier today, but yeah, the Clare Housing is exempted here. Have you
right,
just heard
that's
from
what
that?
I thought.
And then Representative Loeffler, maybe.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, just to, what it does is it says the current law stays in place.
Okay.
And that we have people continuing to work to understand the Supreme Court Olmstead decision and federal regulations that are under develop and come back to us with a process that will work not just for one group, but for all the varied groups that are served by the waivers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So I think what we're being asked to do here is Representative Loeffler's move the A1 amendment. And I think I heard Representative Dean say we want to vote on that, and then there's some additional work that needs to be done here, right, Representative Dean?
That's correct, Madam Chairman.
Okay, so all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails, so we have the bill with the A1 on it. Now, Representative Schoen had a question or a comment.
I would like to offer an amendment to the bill as amended.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, on line 1.15, we reinstated all that language. I'd like to strike 25 and insert 50 to the percentile. And that seems as if we have, in the spirit of working together and meeting maybe in the middle or maybe another inch, that maybe this gets us somewhere after talking to Representative Dean, and it seems like maybe that helps with some compromise between the Loeffler Amendment and Representative Dean's original bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schoen. Did everybody get that amendment? So back on the original bill on line 1.15, what looks like stricken language is no longer stricken language with the amendment that we adopted. And so the amendment, the oral amendment, is to strike 25 and insert 50. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would oppose that. I think it quite honestly puts us at risk of potentially losing federal dollars and violating the court direction, and I really do believe the worst thing we could do is have people go forward and create and build facilities that then ultimately we have to ask them to close. And this is a really complicated area, and you're dealing with all disability groups. I would welcome the chance to have the Department of Human Services and others who would be impacted on this testify on it.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to call on Representative Mullery, and then we'll ask DHS to come down if somebody's in, or and we'll have Representative Dean comment as well. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, as a district that has a lot of these possible units, I think we need to see what the results of a study show. I think this is too great an expansion. Then how would you cut it back if it's decided that it's not the way to go? You could end up with huge numbers of ones that are grandfathered in or something for some reason.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mullery. And Representative Dean, do you want to comment? And then I see our testifier from DHS is coming down, and I think Ms. Abderholden also wanted to comment. So, Representative Dean, did you want to talk before she does?
Sure, Madam Chair and members. I think that one of the things we need to be cognizant of, if you look at the bill, Section 1, Section B, which is line 117, still retains many of the restrictions that are in place. And although with this bill what we're doing helps Clare Housing to proceed, there are other populations and other needs that actually having the current restrictions on do create some situations that may be difficult for them. There's nothing in this bill that precludes local governments from having zoning or other rules and regulations relative to over-concentration of populations. My belief is that that's not necessarily the state's role, that cities as well as other local government units that create their zoning to determine how their city is built, what they do with specific populations of need, I believe that that's best situated for them. So I believe that with the change in 25% to 50%, that I would be, you know, behind this. And I also want to mention that the amendment that we just adopted, this change doesn't stop the sub-cabinet from still coming back with recommendations that may be different from this.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. The department does have some concerns about changing the number without going through the Olmsted planning process. And for just some background for people, the Americans with Disabilities Act passed in 1990 and gave people with disabilities the right to live where they choose in the community. There was a lawsuit that was filed in Georgia, which is called the Olmsted decision. Now, it was a Supreme Court decision which said that people have the right to live in the most integrated setting possible of their choosing. This has resulted in the Department of Justice going to states and evaluating their home and community-based services and where people are receiving services and whether those are truly the most integrated settings possible. The Department of Justice was in Minnesota in 2004 and determined that we didn't need to develop an Olmstead plan, but things have changed since then, and while the Department of Justice isn't requiring us to do an Olmstead plan, we are under a Minnesota court order to develop an Olmstead plan, which is what we're in the process of doing right now. We're required to release the Olmstead plan in June of this year after receiving input from an Olmstead planning committee, and which was comprised of people with disabilities, family members, providers, advocates, counties, and state government. So without having the results of that Olmstead plan available, I'm concerned about making any changes to the concentration number without knowing what the impact is going to be.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Ms. Abderholden.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I'm sorry that I wasn't engaged in this bill earlier, but as you know, we've had a lot on our agenda of this session. I am opposed to increasing it to 50%. I was out in the hall talking about, you know, amending this and had been in contact with Representative Loeffler as well. You know, it's not a choice if your only options are a building with everyone in it having a disability or a mental illness. And unfortunately, especially for people with mental illness, there aren't a lot of options out there. I would much prefer having experienced and seen over, you know, my years in doing this, the ghettoization of people with a serious mental illness. Off West 7th, we had someone buy up a ton of homes, and then everyone who lived there had a serious mental illness. That's not integration into the community, and actually those services were actually pretty awful, and they were finally closed down. I would much rather see an exception process so that if you have someone, you know the type of provider, you can look at their plans, you can make sure that this isn't just, you know, throwing people into a building. I'd much prefer a thoughtful approach to it. You know, I think that making the exception as we have now, bringing a group together to really look at this issue, which I do think is important, but then everybody's really at the table really fully discussing it, which I think would be a really good option. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Anybody else who wants to testify for or against the proposed oral amendment that changes the ratio to 50? Okay. And otherwise, I think, all right, Mr. Larson, final word, and we're going to vote on that.
I'd just like to go on record that the ARC Minnesota is opposed to the 50% for all of the reasons that were cited by both the Representative Loeffler, Representative Mulray, and the other testifiers.
All right, thank you, Mr. Larson. All right, seeing no other comments or questions from members, we'll vote on the oral amendment moved by Representative Schoen. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion does not prevail. So we are back on the bill as amended. Is there any further discussion of the bill 1395 as amended? All right, seeing none. Any final words, Representative Dean, on your bill?
No, there's a bill before you. I ask for your support.
All right, thank you. All right, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1395, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean. She's got people waiting. Let's take hers up. Representative Loeffler, let's take up your bills. House file, which one would you like to do first?
Let's take 1047.
All right, House file 1047.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we will have a DE2 amendment that I don't believe in the packets, but we'll make some good work that's been done by the people working on this.
All right, so Representative Loeffler moves that House File 1047 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance, and then Representative Loeffler moves the DE1 amendment?
DE2 amendment,
oh,
and that's just being distributed right now.
Okay.
And while it's being distributed, maybe I can just tell people a little background, and then we'll get into more as we get into the testimony. But since we're going to be going off into a period in which we get to reconnect with our constituents and not sit in dark, windowless hearing rooms, if you miss seeing paper and serious work and inspiring problems to address, I just want to let you know that this bill is based on the Children's Defense Fund's big report on the 0-3 research project, Maternal Depression in Early Childhood. And they did really impressive work. We all see lots of reports. I have to say this is one of the better, most comprehensive ones I've seen. And so I would just recommend that to you if you're missing the opportunity to learn about human service issues during the
All right. And Representative Loeffler, so in our packets we have a DE1, and that one is not going to be offered, correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair, or the other amendments. The DE2 takes care of incorporating
All right. So
some
in our
work.
Packets then is an A1 and an A2, and those will not be offered.
That's correct.
Okay, just so members can shift their paper piles appropriately, like I'm trying to do. Okay.
And if everyone has the DE2, I have a minor oral amendment.
Okay. State your oral amendment.
And that is on page 6, on line 6.10. It would delete, require that licensees receive continuing education, on line 6.10 to 6.11, and then insert after shall, so as a substitution, provide educational materials. So we're deleting the requirement for continuing ed, but providing that the licensing boards will provide educational materials.
All right, so Representative Loeffler incorporates that change, and I'll restate it for the record. So on line 6.10 of the DE2 amendment, she would like to strike after the word shall, strike the rest of that line, and on 6.11, strike the first word, education. And then on 6.10, insert after the word shall, provide educational materials.
That's correct.
All right, so Representative Loeffler incorporates that change. Is there any question about the change? Representative Schoen.
Representative Loeffler, this is related to continuing ed for nurses and medical staff, and is this a departure in how we're handling continuing ed and just saying, just hand out the papers now instead of making sure we talk about it? Or is that covered somewhere else?
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, you'll note that in your packet there are a number of licensing boards who didn't appreciate the fact that we were mandating a particular number of hours on this particular subject, and they're concerned about the legislature continuing to tell them how to balance out all the needs that they have for continuing ed. And so this gives them the flexibility. The people who have been working on this issue and are more than willing to help them provide materials and help to figure out the best way to deal with it. And so this actually represents their input and I think works well.
All right. Okay. And Representative Schoen, we'll adopt, if everybody's clear about the incorporation, we'll adopt the DE2, and then we can have a full discussion of the contents of what Representative Loeffler's bill is doing, including that issue. So if there are no further questions about the incorporation, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. And so now we have the DE2 before us on the bill, and Representative Loeffler, to you.
Thank
bill.
You, Madam Chair. And maternal depression and its impact on children is an area that, while there's lots of good research, unfortunately, as always, is a challenge. The research and the knowledge doesn't always get into practice as fast as we'd like. 1 in 10 new mothers experience serious depressive symptoms in the first year of their children's life. It doesn't just happen immediately after the birth. That's sometimes a common stereotype. And this affects 14,000 mothers and newborns each year in Minnesota. It happens at all incomes and backgrounds, but because of the stress that people who are low-income, minority, or have limited education have in their lives, there's actually a higher risk with those populations, and research evidence that they're getting less asked about it, quite honestly, when they're getting medical care. 44% of our MFIP families have had a mental health disorder in the past 3 years. This is, showing that correlation between low income, loss of job, and mental health issues. And it's very expensive. And as we know about child brain development, if you have a mother who is just shutting down because of the health experiences that she's having, that baby isn't getting enough stimulation or attention oftentimes, and that can actually affect the baby's brain development in long term. And so early intervention and ID is the key. This bill provides for public awareness, a more effective ID and early intervention, working with both the mother and the baby together where that's the best practice as shown by evidence, and creating a statewide plan across agencies. And so that's kind of it in a bullet, and I have a couple of well-informed testifiers who can provide more insights.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marcy Jeffries, and I'm with the Children's Defense Fund, and we want to thank Representative Loeffler for bringing this important issue forward. We do have lots of paper, and we have a summary of that big report, too, that we could have handed out, but I'll just quickly draw your attention to the handout that's the PowerPoint slides. Representative Loeffler made the major points, but I would just point out that on the second page of that handout, 1 in 10 new mothers in Minnesota, and this is Minnesota data, report that they have experienced serious depressive symptoms at some point in the first year of their child's birth. Some women are more likely to experience them than others, especially women with low incomes and women of color. And women on medical assistance are twice as likely to report depression as other women. Women on private insurance, if it's unaddressed, if maternal depression is unaddressed, it can have an impact on a child's development. And on the top, the table on the top of page 4 shows that this impact can occur at any time during a child's life, and it may be sustained during a child's life if nothing is done to address those issues starting at birth. Maternal depression works through the mechanisms of making it more difficult sometimes for mothers to nurture their child, to respond to a child's cries or smiles. It may also affect a mother's ability to do basic caregiving, make sure a child's in a car seat and fed regularly, and it may have a physiological effect. It works through cortisol, raising stress hormone levels in the mother, can be passed on to the child while she's pregnant, and then both mother and child have elevated cortisol levels. So that's the mechanism through which then you can see these things happening throughout childhood. The impact is greatest when it happens when it's a newborn. Wilder Research estimates that it costs the state $23,000 a year, mostly in terms of lost productivity and health care costs for a mother and child with unaddressed maternal depression. And as Representative Loeffler said, early screening and referral and identification and a two-generation approach is really the best way to go, and it can be effectively treated. We have a good deal of research and data on what works. So House Bill 1047 builds on the strengths that Minnesota already has and to strengthen our system. But also point out, we also handed out testimony from Dr. Helen Kim, who is a psychiatrist at Hennepin County Medical Center and very knowledgeable on these issues. And she talks about the impact of impaired parenthood and how important it is and the impact it can have on children, infants, because they're totally dependent on their caregivers for survival and nurturance. So would you like to go through the bill?
Madam Chair and members, would you like us to go through the bill in detail now?
I don't know if that's necessary, Representative Loeffler. Maybe we should hear from your other testifier, and then members could ask questions. I think that would be sufficient. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I am Joan Brandt, Family Health Section Manager for St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health. Currently, I manage the Public Health Nursing Section that does the home visiting unit for St. Paul Ramsey County. I'm testifying today in support of House File 1047 on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting, as well as the local Public Health Association of Minnesota, which represents city, county, and tribal public health departments across the state. Each year, nearly 7,500 babies are born in Ramsey County. As you've already heard, Wilder Research estimates that about 10% of babies are born and cared by moms who suffer from maternal depression. In addition, Wilder calculates that related costs for non-treatment of depression at nearly about $23,000 a year. Public health home visiting interventions provide support and assistance to these women and their families. The biggest challenge to our programs is finding the women. Maternal depression, as you've heard, affects the basic needs of all family members.
In addition, when a mother or primary caretaker is depressed, the typical activities that might bring her to the attention of a professional in the community are impacted. Children are less likely to receive well child care exams. She's less likely to see her doctor for a postpartum follow-up. Her family is not connected to resources within the community, such as targeted home visiting, where she would receive the screening, support, referral, and follow-up that's necessary. One area of greatest concern is the impact of maternal depression on the brain development of the new baby. When a mom is depressed, has a depressed affect, the impact on the baby is significant. That interaction between the baby, the healthy interaction between the mom and the baby is certainly interrupted. The serve and return interaction that impacts the natural learning process is disrupted and ultimately impacts the child's brain development. Babies who do not receive nurturing responses on a consistent basis from their caregivers will begin to show delays as early as 6 months of age. By 18 months of age, babies have fewer words and early literacy skills are ultimately delayed. All of this impacts their school readiness. Without early intervention, even the child's ability to read at grade level in third grade is impacted. The results of the recent adverse childhood events, or the ACE study, demonstrates that having a depressed parent can have lifelong implications for health and well-being. The nature of maternal depression is isolation. Identifying women who are depressed is difficult. Universal screening provided at places in the community, such as WIC, where we most frequently meet new moms and young families who are most at risk, would be very helpful in increasing the number of mothers and families we can connect to treatment and resources. We know that targeted home visiting and in-home parenting support are effective strategies to identify mothers who are depressed and then link them to the appropriate resources. Additionally, moms who aren't diagnosed within the first 6 months after their babies are born, early identification and intervention is key since so much of brain development occurs prenatally and within those first 2 years of life. Being able to support depressed mothers throughout this crucial developmental time is very important to our success in decreasing the long-term pathological effects of maternal depression. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. Are there questions from members? Oh, Representative Mullery, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Jeffries, as you know, I'm extremely interested in this issue, and you're even more interested. But I also know that there's a reason why the Supreme Court makes us attorneys go to continuing legal education courses. It's because people don't read things. They can sign affidavits, they've read it, they don't, and we all know that. If we hooked you up to a lie detector test, would you say that providing educational material is as good for what both of you are, both you and I are really interested in this, as receiving continuing education?
Was that for Ms. Jeffries?
If you don't want to answer, then I think we know.
We, no lie detectors here, Ms. Jeffries, but...
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I honestly do not know the real answer to that because I'm not licensed, so I don't know what the implications are. I would think, though, having done some continuing education for people, that that would be the most effective way to get the information to people. But we did hear a lot of opposition to that provision.
Well, Madam Chair, the attorneys put in a lot of opposition to continuing education all the time and did it again when they added ethics, did it again when they added bias. And the Supreme Court went ahead and did it despite opposition. And Representative Loeffler, I would hope you somehow get that in, because I know what happens if it's not. And just because people are like, you know, I don't love to go to continuing education courses, but it is effective.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, I share your concern about making sure that we have it effective. Quite honestly, I'd like to have it in the base training of people rather than continuing ed. So they might be in their 30th year of practice before they chose to take this particular class, because they have lots of classes to choose from. The training of health professionals across the full range of licenses is very complicated, and each approaches it differently. And so I did feel that talking to the people who do licensing, there are issues that I was not able to work with them adequately enough to address, because this would affect the licenses not just of physicians but also social workers. I've heard from chiropractors. I mean, it's everybody has a different system, and I'm not yet able to understand how to best intervene in all of those. And quite honestly, like I say, I'm even more interested in making sure that our initial training prepares people for these challenges.
Thank you. And I just want to add, Representative Mullery, not all attorneys really are happy with what the attorneys have to do. So I just want to make that note, Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I think I said that most attorneys can't stand going to those. But the Supreme Court understands it's necessary. And Representative Loeffler, the fact that there's different things, all you said is that licensees receive continuing education, which doesn't say, you know, all of them have to have 30 hours of it or all of them have to have specific course. It means merely that they have to have some continuing education. And I think that this is such an extremely important topic. I mean, this relates to the whole existence of my new committee. And so I'm very unhappy about that being taken out, and I hope that it gets back in before it hits the floor.
Madam Chair and
Representative Loeffler
and Representative Mullery, I invite you to join me in the discussions and trying to figure out who most of all the licensees actually interacts with these people most, and we'll have a good discussion with a lot of people.
All right. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at Section 4, the home visiting program, and I'm just, maybe I had to step out for a few minutes, so maybe you talked about this, but I'm just curious about that. How does that work, and is that something that's voluntary that people request, or just talk about that a little bit more for me?
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and we do not have mandatory home visiting unless it would be court-ordered because of some concerning effort that had gotten to that level, but it has been proven to be a very effective and oftentimes more welcomed intervention than having to go out and, you know, bundle up the kids and get to a practitioner who's allowed to spend maybe 12 minutes with you, as opposed to a licensed nurse who's got a specialty in working with these families. And it can follow along with them and be a resource to them even in between visits in terms of calling and stuff. So that's the nature of the program.
Representative Lohmer? Okay. Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment. We all know that postpartum depression is real and affects real lives. Something that I'd like our committee to also look at is There's a group called Silent No More. It's women who have had abortions that have suffered immense emotional harm because of, and that's something else I think our committee needs to look at, is the link of depression with women that have had abortions, because that is not being discussed in this committee at all. So, and we're doing them a great disservice.
Well, thank you, Representative Franson. We discuss the things that come before the committee usually in the form of a bill. But I think that's real. The things that come before the committee usually in the form of a bill. But I think that's really off topic here, because we're talking about impact on babies. So I think that's a whole other topic, although certainly depression is depression, but a lot of people have depression. So other members, let's see, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was just going to... You talked about the licensing boards, Representative Loeffler, and I think that they cover a lot of the needs in continuing ed along those routes, too, and I get where you're coming from on the mandating in state statute, and probably not so necessary when we have direction in those other areas, and Representative Mullery and you lawyers probably need to be guided a little bit more by the Supreme Court than most of us, so, okay.
No foul intent to the chair.
just Representative Mullery.
Okay, thank you. So I think we're ready to... I'm not seeing any other questions. Is there? I don't know if I asked if there's anyone else who wanted to testify on the bill. Oh, okay. Ms. Abderholden was on the list, but she's kind of shaking her head. She doesn't need to come down. So with that, Representative Loeffler will renew her motion that House File 1047 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you
and Representative Loeffler. And then Representative Loeffler has House File 856. And Representative Loeffler will move that House File 856 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And
thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill just adds schizoaffective disorder to the list of diagnoses that are defined in statutes as an adult with acute mental illness. And so it's a pretty small change, but important for people who are facing that challenge. And I am glad to welcome Sue Abderholden and another witness to help us understand this better.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden with NAMI, Minnesota. schizoaffective disorder is a serious mental illness that affects about 1 in 100 people. A person who has schizoaffective disorder will experience delusions, hallucinations, and other symptoms that are characteristic of schizophrenia and significant disturbances in their mood. It's thought to be kind of between bipolar and schizophrenia because it has features of both. We are seeing more and more people diagnosed with this, and yet they don't qualify for case management when it's as just as serious as schizophrenia, depression, and bipolar disorder. You hear from me a lot, and so I'm going to stop talking, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Ivey.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, and we hear from you a lot, and we always appreciate it. You always have important information to give the committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and the committee. My name is Marlon Ivey, and I do have schizoaffective syndrome, and I do apologize because of my mental health. Sometimes I lose focus, but I catch back up, and I'm very nervous right now. So,
well, that's all right. We're glad to have you here, and relax. And believe me, all of us here lose focus at
okay.
times.
All right, thanks. And I'm just kind of give you some background on what it was like for me when back in the day. I pretty much woke up every morning like crying and depressed and really lost and really had like weird thoughts and kind of like I couldn't go to the grocery store. I was so scared of people. And I really didn't understand what was going on with me until I went to a therapist for the first time. And he kind of explained to me that I had schizoaffective syndrome. They say it all different, and it means a lot of different things. So he explained to me how important it was and that I take care of myself and just all kind of stuff. And I remember he gave me his card when I was leaving and told me if I have any problems, like, give him a call, and he's right there for me. So, like, 2 days later, I was going through an issue, and I gave him a call, and I got an answer machine. And I left a message and waited for a call back, and got a call back 2 days later from a nurse that I never met. And she represented 3 different therapists there and asked me which one was mine and just kind of, like, weird. So I told her who my therapist was, and she said she'd get back to me. And I never received a call from my therapist. And, you know, the reason why I bring that up because it was like 6 days through this whole process, and a lot of people with mental health and the way I had depression, we don't have 6 days to wait for people to call us back. And a lot of times during that period, I did end up in a hospital for suicide attempts. So I went on like this for 3 years, and just going back and forth with different therapists and all kind of different medications, and you know, along with having bad mental health, you develop bad physical health too. And you know, I became morbid obese. I was 450 pounds. I had diabetes. I had high cholesterol, high blood pressure, pretty much high everything. I had sleep apnea so bad that I stopped breathing 80 times an hour. And it was talking about putting a trach in my throat just to keep me alive. And then, you know, the weirdest thing happened. My insurance, I had MA, like Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they dropped whatever with the MA, and I had to switch over to Medica. And with Meta came a wellness coordinator, aka case manager. And that's kind of like where my life changed, because it was somebody who I just remember the beginning when we first met, and it's like I sat in her office and we talked about my goals and what was going to go on. And I remember I called the next day, and she called me back within an hour or two. And I've been working with her for 4 years, and I pretty much talk to her every single day. Or if not, she calls me or I call her. And, you know, we kind of just took steps, baby steps, to get my life back together. She helped me manage my life. And as you can see, I lost the weight, of course. You know what I'm saying? I went back to school to get my associate's degree, of course. And just the guy who couldn't go in a grocery store, I'm that guy in there just in there smiling, just looking at the fruit and shaking it now. You know what I'm saying? Just my whole life is different. You know what I'm saying? And like I said, we need somebody there every day for us. And that's that was most important to me, that she was there every day. And then let me see what else I got here. And when I was scared to go to the doctor, she went with me. You know, just kind of that good person. And her name is Jody Lewis. She's sitting right there. So I thought I was going to give her a shout out.
Yeah. All right.
And if you think about it, it's like the financial benefits of having a case manager. You know, I was a person who went to the doctor 9 to 12 times a month. I woke up every morning. I took 13 pills, sometimes three times a day, and the state is paying for all this. I couldn't work. I was disabled. I shot up insulin. I became diabetic. I had to use insulin. That's $1,000 a month. I had back problems, you know, $2,000 MRIs and just all this other type stuff. You know what I'm saying? Now, I go to the doctor once every 3 months. Now, I went from somebody who was completely dependent on the state, and 2 weeks ago, I got a job. So I can take care of myself a little better. And, you know, as I sit here, you know what I'm saying, I listen to all these bills, and, you know, I support all of them, by the way, just for the record.
Thank you.
And we always welcome them.
Yeah. And you know, it's kind of sad in a way, because it's like these programs need money to care for people, but at the end of the day, it's only people that can care for people. Money can't care for people. And you know what, I say that because in early 90s, my brother, he was murdered. He was shot in the head in the streets of St. Paul. Two years later, I was on my way to school and found my dad had passed away in his sleep and found him on the couch. And then 4 years after that, my younger brother and best friend died of meningitis. So I spent a lot of time at the cemetery visiting them. And when I go there, I take time to reflect and just kind of like try to learn different things. And if you ever go there and read tombstones, it's all about beloved this, beloved that. You know, this person was a caregiver to the world and just all kind of stuff like that. It's never about this person drove this kind of car, or this person lived in this type of neighborhood, or this person carried this type of bag. So it kind of it's all about people and caring about people. And I'm not going to take up much more time. I just want to say that everybody should treat everybody equally and fair, no matter what's going on with them. Because I call this a Marlinism. So, you know, no matter if you drive a Pinto or a Bentley, we all need a tune-up every 3 months. So.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Ivey. We really appreciate it. You sure didn't sound like a guy who was nervous once you got going, and we really thank you for bringing that perspective. That's a really good thing for us to hear, and for this committee, a lot of the issues you're speaking to really are very important to us. We appreciate your coming down here today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
If I might just add a personal note, as you might have seen, Mr. Ivey, I tend to talk up a lot in these kind of committees, and I present a bunch of bills, and I have to say you've been the most compelling story of success that I've heard in several years. And so I think you should just be so proud of yourself for going so far. And thank you for giving the shout out to the partner on this journey.
That's my partner.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abderholden, just a quick question. I just wondered why whatever it is, anyhow, 4I isn't it fairly limited? I mean, there's other I you have the technical term, but the multiple personalities disorder, there's various ones that aren't in that. I just wondered why in a real short couple sentences.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Representative Miller, the way the Adult Mental Health Act is structured is that if you could have any diagnosis and fail several times, basically, and get into the case management system. But just pulling out the major illnesses where you want to try to intervene a little bit earlier, and that's why this is in there. Someday I would like to just, you know, really redo the whole thing, but for right now, it's kind of a patchwork, I guess.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So with that, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 856 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And all right. So the last bill on the agenda is House File 1157. Let's see, did Representative Schumacher?
Representative Liebling, when you're ready, the motion you want to make is to recommend to pass and re-refer House File 1157 to the Committee of Health and Human Service Finance.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that would be the motion. So, Mr. Chair and members, we also have a technical amendment on the bill, which I'd like to move right now to get the bill in the correct order, and that is the 0227 amendment, which I believe we should have in the packets.
Okay.
We could move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right,
Chair.
You move that amendment?
Correct.
All right, and to your amendment.
All right, that's just a technical amendment, Mr. Chair, if we could just have a vote on that and get the bill in the shape in which we'd like to discuss it, and then I'll have my testifier explain what it all does.
Okay. Any discussion on this ahead of time? Okay, all in favor of the 0227 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed? All right, motion passes.
Okay. All right, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And members, this is, as you might note, this is, I'm not the chief author of this bill. This is Representative Norton's bill, but she was not able to be here today. And so I'm going to let Mr. Zimmer explain the bill to you, and then I'm sure he'll be glad to take questions as well.
All right, Mr. Zimmer, could you please introduce yourself for the record and go on with your testimony?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dan Zimmer. I'm the director for Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance Commission. The bill, House File 1157, is us tweaking some current legislation. It was first enacted in 1998, which established Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance Commission. And since that time, I think every legislative session we've come back and tweaked a little bit and looked at the legislation that governs us, bringing forward positive changes to that. Let's just start with the amendment. We did talk 2 weeks ago with the Department of Human Services, and the amendment is coming from those discussions in that they wanted better clarification of some of the wording. And technically, it's looking at allowing providers in Region 10 that are not in an opted-in county to join us and into our system. But I think I'm kind of jumping around a little bit. Let me start where I wanted to start with, and then I'll explain the bill. Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance has been working since 1998 to do alternative licensing for providers in the southeastern part of Minnesota. Through our 15-year history, I think we're best known for our process, which is called VOICE, which really looks at establishing quality assurances for people with disabilities based on their own individual values, based on their expectations, looking at how those providers are meeting the expectations of that person. To do this, the VOICE process is really a series of discussions with that participant, with the people that are receiving services, with their families, with direct care staff, with case managers, if they're in school, with school systems, could be with churches. It really depends on that person. But at the end of the day, we really try to determine who is this person, what does this person need, and how is everybody comprehensively working together to help them achieve the outcomes that they want. We use the information in twofold. One, we use it for quality improvement, where all that information goes back to that person, goes back to all the services that that person is utilizing, and they're able to do quality improvement for that person right up front. The second means that we use it for is licensing component, where we do replace Department of Human Services licensing. We have a board that reviews the random selection voice reviews that are done, and they can look at the provider and say, are they meeting the needs of specific individuals from that random sample? Again, we've been working on this for over 15 years. We're confident that our abilities and our results have shown that we're a good system. Over the years, different parts of the state have looked at doing what we're doing, and we've made progress. We've stepped back. We're making progress again. 2011, a state quality council was formed, which is a stakeholder group throughout the state. Their first report from their first year came out, I believe, just this Monday. And in that report, they're talking about moving our state licensing system, our state quality assurance management system, to more of a regional model similar to what we're doing. So looking at their proposals and working with that state quality council, they have continually come to us and saying they're looking for us for advice. They're looking for us to be a resource for other parts of the state if that development does occur. And so as we were coming forward in this legislative session, we felt that we really needed to strengthen our system to make certain that we will be viable, we will be there when other areas of the state may be doing something similar to what we're doing. Right now in their report, I believe they're talking about those regional councils maybe being phased in starting 2016. So it's not like it's something that's next year. So that's why we felt that we needed to go forward with what we're doing. Looking at House File 1157, the first item is our sunset date. We currently have a sunset date of June 30th, 2014. We're asking for that to be altered. Another section is talking about just stipends, and that in the past, counties paid for those stipends. We are now using that from our funding that we receive. And so we've taken out that counties will pay to say that stakeholders may be paid a stipend for their work. We utilize a lot of volunteers for some of the work that we do. If they're not being paid by their employer at that time, we will pay a stipend for them. However, I'd like to point out that we have many, many volunteers that are eligible for stipends that don't request one from us. Another area that we wanted to talk about is we added 245D, in that our Department of Human Services developing a new set of standards, 245D. Right now, we are an alternative standards for 245B. So we wanted to make certain that 245D was in there to give us the opportunity that when the time comes and 245D is ratified and moving forward, it could be as early as January 2014, that we'd have an opportunity to have a discussion with Department of Human Services and request a variance and move forward to see if our standards could uphold that as well.
Sure. Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Zimmer, if you could just tell us what that is, that'd be helpful. We might not memorize the numbers.
No, that's fine.
Mr. Zimmer.
There's currently 245B refers to most of the developmental disability waivers, whether residents or DT, day training and habilitation services, support and employment services, and it's a licensing set of standards for them. We have alternative standards that we use in our area that replaces 245B. 245D covers other services that have licenses like traumatic brain injury, CAC, which I'm unfortunately I don't know exactly what that acronym stands for, but there's other services that are out there that have a license but until this point have not been regularly monitored. Department of Human Services is putting together a plan to monitor them the way I feel they should be. And our role, as we see going forward, is to help with those monitoring. We really feel that our standards will cover those other services. We have done some test pilots with the traumatic brain injury as well as nursing homes, and we've seen that our voice reviews are positive and have made quality improvement for individuals in those types of services as well. So in our where we're looking at with this bill is positioning us that if our state is monitoring like traumatic brain injury services, we feel our voice review would be able to do the same. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Zimmer? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just looking through here, the one thing that sticks out is this. You mentioned that this is kind of instituted 15 years ago as a project, and one of the big changes, obviously, is making it so it never sunsets. And I'm wondering if you were going to insert a date back in to have it reviewed, or kind of what the plan is moving forward.
Mr. Zimmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerbus, our history has shown that, yes, government ops usually puts a new sunset date in there. However, this might be a different situation in that we really see our legislation as being temporary now, in that we have a state quality council. That state quality council is going forward with recommendations that we're hopeful that when it does become regional, we're just going to be part of the state system. We're not going to be an option anymore. And our legislation will go away, and it'll be the state system. But we do anticipate that government ops probably will put a date on there. We'd like it not to be there, but we'll see what they say.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Zimmer? Any other testifiers on this bill? Seeing none, I think we're ready to go to any last words, Representative Liebling.
No, thank you. Thank you for hearing the bill today, members.
All right. Then Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 1157 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? All right. The bill passes. I'm not going to adjourn you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for taking the gavel. And so, members, this is the last regular meeting of this committee. I think we'll be convening again after deadline, probably, if we may get some bills through the Rules Committee. We may also have some informational hearings, maybe still yet during session or even during the interim, but since this is our last regularly scheduled meeting, I did want to take the opportunity to thank our staff, our Paige, who's over there, who's been so, quietly wonderful and serving us all this time. Karen Brindleson, I hope I'm saying your name right. And then, of course, Lynn Sando, who's our committee legislative assistant. and Matthew Bergeron, who's our committee administrator. So I want to thank them for their wonderful work this session, and thank you all for your attention. Representative Loeffler.
I'm sure just because you've lost a little focus, I think we need to thank both our partisan staff and our nonpartisan staff.
Oh, thank you very much, Representative Loeffler.
It's been
of
a long
course.
Couple of days. For
yes,
all of
it has, and our staff that are kind of our unsung heroes in the committee, and so we really appreciate everybody's hard work. And any other questions or comments? Things I've forgotten to say? Anybody wants to remind me? Okay. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.